Hey, everyone. So it's August, which means we are taking a bit of a break before we return in a few weeks with a whole bunch of new episodes. But even while we are away, we are still putting out new content every single week. My conversations from the How I Built This virtual summit. And this Thursday, it's Adam Grant, the author of best-selling books like Think Again and Originals. He's got some really excellent advice on how to think creatively, how to know when you're in a rut, and how to get out of said rut. Adam and I spoke back in May, and that conversation will be in your podcast feed later this week. But in the meantime, we're replaying my interview with Logic and Chris Saru from 2019. And even if you've heard it before, we can all agree that this one really is totally worth hearing again. It is one of the best episodes of the show ever. So here you go.
I met a lot of shady people who wanted to manage me. I didn't feel like I was a priority. It was a bunch of guys who knew everything and were telling me, you gotta have a girl record, you gotta have a hard record, I have a record for the club, you got this, you got that, and they're like telling me what to do. And I sat down with a young man who had just as much experience as I did and was prepared to risk everything to attain his dream. And he needed me as much as I needed him. And I was like, yeah, let's like YOLO, like let's do it, man.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how a broke rapper and an aspiring music manager with no experience teamed up to top the Billboard charts and build a multi-million dollar business. So about 2 years ago, if you turned on a pop music station, you could not get away from this song. I've been on a low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. It feel like my life ain't mine. I don't want to be alive. Now, if you don't know this track, it's worth listening to. The title of the song is 1-800-273-8255. This also happens to be the phone number for the American National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. This song blew up on the Billboard charts. It was nominated for a Grammy, and it actually turned Logic, the rapper behind the track, into a superstar. This song, as you can imagine, is about pain, about the pain of loneliness and depression, two subjects that aren't always front and center in the world of hip-hop. And the thing about this song is, when Logic performs it live, people in the audience break down and cry. So many people connect with it in a deep and personal way, almost like he's rapping about their exact experiences. But Logic, who was actually born Sir Robert Bryson Hall II, was writing something that authentically describes his own experience about growing up around violence and addiction, without a stable home life, and sometimes without anywhere to live. And the chances that he'd one day be performing in front of tens of thousands of people was so totally remote. But what Logic could do was write music and rap. And for the most part, that's what he was doing 10 years ago, in and around the Washington, D.C. area. At around the same time, Chris Saru was a recent college graduate struggling to find work in the music industry. In fact, he couldn't even get an internship at any of the big record labels when he first came across Logic. But we'll get there. Because the story of how Logic built the brand Logic is as much about his talent as a musician as it is about Chris Saru's talent as a marketer. And today's episode is about what happens when two totally different people with totally different skill sets happen to meet. And just a note, you'll hear from Chris a bit later. First to Logic, who, as I mentioned, was born Sir Robert Bryson Hall II.
My dad likes to tell me now that we have a better relationship that he's the one who named me that, but I know it was my mom because she's like of English descent if you go far back enough, and she's an eccentric woman, and she decided to name me, you know, Sir first. And my father's name is Robert Bryson Hall, and so she named me Sir Robert Bryson Hall II, wherein technically because she added the sir, I'm actually the first, which is really funny. And whenever I have a boy, I'll name him the third, but he'll be the second.
So tell me about your parents. And I guess you were the only child of their marriage or their time together. Were they married?
Yep. They were never married. I was born out of wedlock. My mom, like the nitty gritty of it is she's just a deep, 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 deep down good woman who, you know, at a young age was molested. She'd been raped growing up. She got into all kind of drugs, running around with drug dealers. And my father was never really in the picture because he was addicted to crack cocaine.
So when you were little, it was just, it was, you never knew your dad. You just knew your mom.
Yeah, well, I knew my dad, you know, but I knew him as a drug addict, which is messed up, you know. But he, yeah, it was like he'd go away for a few years and then he'd come back and he'd leave and then he'd come back. And but they were never together. That's the one thing is like they, it's really weird. I've seen my mom go back to a lot of men. She never went back to him. I never had that moment or that time of where I felt like family.
So your mom and dad, basically, they had a brief relationship. You're the product of that relationship. Your dad is African-American. Your mom is Caucasian. She's white.
Yeah.
And tell me about, like, where you grew up. Did you grow up in a house or an apartment?
Yeah, we grew up in Section 8 housing, so food stamps, welfare. We had a few hundred dollars a month from the government to live off.
It was you and your mom?
Yeah, just me and my mom. She spent a lot of that in different times on, you know, alcohol and cigarettes. And I you know, remember times where we'd have $3.50 that could have bought us some rice and some powdered eggs. And, you know, she'd buy a pack of cigarettes. And I grew up with her saying the craziest things. Like, I was just a kid, you know? I was a hyper kid. And then if I pissed her off, she'd say things like, you deserve to feel pain. Or she'd call me a or any of these crazy things because of the systemic racism that was deep down inside her, which is insane. But mind you, it's like she was troubled. So I feel bad for her. It's not like I'm like, oh, my mom, screw her, terrible woman. It's just like, was she a good mom? No. Was she a human being who had a terrible past and took that out on me and her other kids? Yes. And that's the reason she's not in my life. It's just that simple.
So you grew up with your mom mainly, and you would see your dad from time to time. And was he... would he sort of go in and out of bad spells, or was he constantly, you know, using drugs?
Yeah, he was pretty much constantly using drugs. You know, a lot of my childhood was in AA meetings. Like, you know, just kind of reciting the prayer at the end of it and listening to all these people talk about all the things they go through, which is so hard and it's so difficult, and seeing people, you know, just kind of using again and then getting clean and this and that. And my dad was like that. One of my earliest childhood memories, I was about 5, and my dad, I don't know why I was with him, but I was with him for, I think, the weekend, and my dad took me to Southeast D.C. and left me in a car, back of a car for 5 hours while him and some woman I didn't know went to go smoke crack in this house, which was insane. It's crazy.
How did you avoid, like, getting into drugs and alcohol?
It just really, really, really scared me. You know, I ran around. I've done a lot of stuff. I've shot guns. I've robbed people. I've ran from the police. I've done a bunch of stupid things because I was around other stupid people because I felt that they were my family. You know, it's why a lot of young men and women join actual, like, real gangs. It's because they have nothing at home, and here's a family who will protect them. And it's kind of sick and twisted because it's like, okay, we're going to hurt other people, but these people won't hurt me. So we'll hurt others together, and then at least that way I'm safe. Hmm. But there was that voice deep down that was like, yo, like, this isn't right. And for me, when I got into music for real, and I was 18, and I was like, I'm not going to let anything hold this back. My father is an incredible musician, singer, percussionist, playing go-go in Chocolate City, D.C. I mean, amazing. And I saw what cocaine did to him. Hmm. And I was like, I can't let this happen to me. So that's why I steered clear from it.
Hmm. So sticking with music for a second, being exposed to it, I guess as a teenager, you started to meet some people who kind of took an interest in you musically. Who were they?
Well, kind of even when it comes to music, I had a friend named Josh. Mm-hmm. And he was, who would eventually go on to be my godmother's son, and her name was Mary Jo, and I love her, and she's the sweetest woman in the world. And he kind of saw that I had a niche for raps. I just freestyled, you know, on the block with all my friends and had fun. And so he was a person that was there, and a gentleman named Solomon Taylor, who was my mentor.
Who's Solomon?
So Solomon was this guy that I met when I was volunteering at RFL, which is the Rockville Football League, just to get extra credit to be able to pass eighth grade. So I was 13. Mm-hmm. He was 19 at the time. And he's a hustler. So basically, you have all these football. I would set up the football fields, and you'd have like Pee Wee and, you know, these kids in middle school and stuff playing football. And what he would do is he would show up, and how he built this whole kind of business is he would film the kids' games and then duplicate the tapes, create highlights, and then sell those to the parents, which was really amazing. And then so we became friends, and then I eventually kind of worked for him at his booth, and he paid me nothing. And it taught me a lot about a lot in the winter and the freezing cold and the snow standing at a booth outside. And this dude was there for me. He introduced me to, you know, so many incredible MCs. He brought me these old things called How to Be an MC CDs, which is basically like a bunch of instrumentals, famous instrumentals of the 2000s. And he'd be like, rap on these. And I would literally rap on every single song. And if he gives me 10 CDs, there's like 80 beats. I rapped on those. And he was cool. And he was great. He was a good dude.
I read that when the movie Kill Bill came out, you got the soundtrack to that film, which was produced and composed by RZA from Wu-Tang Clan. And that was like a huge like turning point for you. You heard this and you were like, what is this?
Yeah. Man, that movie, like, just something about it. It was probably also the fact that my mom was like, you can't watch this, it's too bloody. And then, you know, your parents say don't do something and then you want to go do it. When I heard that soundtrack, I was like, who the hell is the RZA? You know? And like, this was like back in the time, like where it was like, pop, lock and drop it and do that, laugh it, tap it. It was like the whole South, like fun turn up music. Yeah. But I wanted something a little deeper. I'd listen to ATLians and, you know, so Outkast, UGK, like hearing those stories. So after being introduced to the RZA, I found Wu-Tang Clan. I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job. And obviously we've all heard of Wu-Tang Clan.
Sure.
But I'm a 14-year-old kid. Like, I don't really know. I'm learning. And then I listen to Wu-Tang, and I'm listening to the Wu-Tang album, and then I discover Raekwon's Only Built for Cuban Links, and then I discover Nas, and then I discover the beef between Nas and Jay-Z, like, truly. If it wasn't for Kill Bill, if it wasn't for The RZA, if it wasn't for Tarantino, dude, like, we wouldn't even be talking right now.
So when you were, like, already a teenager, were you just, like, would you just rap with friends, like, just mess around and just, like, you know, throw out rhymes or just try to imitate your favorite artists, or did that come later?
Yeah, no, that was, yeah, for sure. Like, we would always do freestyles, but I took it seriously. When I was 15 and I was introduced to how to record myself through, you know, a BS microphone into a computer, like, I took it seriously. And I learned to emulate all my favorites. How does Pac rap like this? How does Jay do this? How does Kanye do that? I want to rap over this boom bap 90s beat, this Run DMC beat. Okay, now I want to rap over super mainstream hit song. I want to sing like Drake. I want to do this like that. I wanted to do it all.
So take me back to 2007. You're 17. You leave home. You stop living with your mom. And you're working jobs. But you're also making music. But how are you actually making music? Like, did you buy a microphone, and like, did you have a computer, and like, how are you actually doing that?
I was on a Yahoo messaging chat about music and hip hop, and some person introduced me to a program for recording. A lot of people use it in radio called Adobe Audition.
Sure.
And I was like, what the hell is that? I don't know what that is. And this is back in the day where like this small file took probably about 9 hours. The person actually was sat with me for 9 hours on my computer. So they were somewhere else. I think it had been Alaska. I don't remember. And they transferred the file onto my computer.
It was an illegal download.
100%. Everything was.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so I learned kind of how to use that. And by the time I was 18 years old and living with Mary Jo and had two jobs, Solomon had provided me with a PC, very strong PC at the time, and a million torrented albums. I mean, from Jay-Z to R. Kelly, I was rapping on Brian McKnight beats. Like, it was whatever. It didn't matter what it was.
You would just take, like, beats and, like, samples from other records and then just, like, mess around and rap over those?
Yeah, and I would just, like, loop them. I would, like, loop the end of the beat, and I had the beat. And I did that with a $80 microphone in a jerry-rigged closet with a pillows around it and just would just go. I would just go and go and go. And I would just, it's wild. And the crazy thing is I have every song I've ever created.
Wow. But you thought you were going to, I mean, you were like working Jiffy Lube or whatever job you could get, but like you really thought, I am going to make a career out of being a performer. Like this is what I'm going to do. Like you really thought that?
That moment came 2 years later. I was 20 years old, and it's before I put out my first mixtape ever called Young, Broken, Infamous to the public on the hosting site datpiff.com.
But you would just put your mixtape out there of your own music, and anybody could put their music on the site?
Yeah, anybody could put their music on the site. I think you had to pay like $50 or something to upload it, but that was the time, that was the moment. Step to the mic and now I got you, call me Young Sinatra. The flow is prominent, hella dominant, on time and when I'm rhyming it, said the label's itching to sign with it. There's actually a song on there called Young Sinatra, which then inspired the series. So then my following mixtape was Young Sinatra, then Young Sinatra 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's when I said, I was working at a supermarket, I quit, and I was like, this is it. This is everything. I'm just going to do it. Now is the time. I'm young. It's okay to fail now. It's okay to fall down because I don't want to look back in my 50s like with regret. Can you imagine being, you know, 50, 60, 70 years old filled with regret? There was that voice in my head like, nah, man, you can do this. And that's when I went to go live with Lenny in his basement in College Park.
So you were living in a basement with a friend in College Park. It's around 2010, 2009, 2010. Yeah. I'm trying to understand. I mean, you decide, I'm going to make a go at this. Like, you're putting out mixtapes, and I guess you're performing locally. You're, like, going to open mics and stuff. But you had no money. You were still, I'm assuming you were still pretty broke.
Oh, you don't understand. I was so broke that I would steal quarters from Lenny's little, like, collection that he had so I could go buy food. And he actually, like, screamed at me and was like, just ask, man. Like, it's all good. Like, you just got, you know, all you got to do is ask. And I didn't have a job. I was supposed to get a job when I moved in with him. And I was living with him, his brother, and his mother who passed away, named Kathy, beautiful woman, so amazing, took care of me. And I kind of just sat down with him and was like, can you just give me a year? Like, can you just give me one? I know this is insane, but it seems like every week something new is and exciting is happening. And now is the moment. Like, could you just give me just 1 year? And this was 2011. So I was 20. I was just turned 21. And he gave for a year. I did everything I could, and
you just put out music on the internet. You weren't selling it at that point.
It was all free.
All right, we're gonna come back to Logic in just a couple minutes because while he is crashing at his friend's basement, his future manager Chris Saru is going to college in New York. Now, at this point, they do not know each other. And in fact, a career in music isn't even on Chris's radar because at that point in his life, he was laser-focused on soccer.
I thought I was going to be a professional athlete. I played soccer very competitively growing up all the way through high school and got an opportunity to play Division I, which I thought was the first step to, you know, completing that goal, right?
Where were you playing, by the way? What college?
I my freshman year, I played for Canisius College in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that was the best opportunity for me at the time. They're a very competitive team. Soon after that, I think after my sophomore year, and I had transferred in between then to play at a different school, I realized that I just, you know, I wasn't good enough. I was very good, but I wasn't good enough to play at the higher level.
So I'm trying to figure out how you like made a transition into music. I mean, did you just think, I'm not going to do sports. I'm going to get into the music business.
Yeah, I was 20 or 19 probably at the time when I started trying to figure it out. I knew when I stopped playing, I wanted to do something I loved and was passionate about. I think that's all I knew. So yeah. I kind of asked myself, you know, what else do I love as much as that sport? And the only thing that I could answer with was music. So I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I didn't know where I'd start. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any relationships. So I would literally go to Barnes & Noble and kind of read books on the music business and try and figure it out. And I chose management because I thought it would be the least barrier to entry. And I was like, okay, if I find talent and start working with them, that would be my way into the business.
But you didn't think, like, let me go, like, see if I can get a job working for, like, one of these big record labels or management companies and kind of get experience. Like, that wasn't where what you thought you should do at first?
I tried. I definitely tried that route. I started with internships. I didn't graduate college yet, so I didn't really apply for jobs. But at almost every major record label, I applied for internships. And, you know, I kept getting turned down one after the other. I actually got one interview that they actually had me come in for an interview. And I thought it went great. And ultimately, they said, you know, sorry, this isn't going to work. And I just remember I emailed the woman and I asked, I actually still have the email. I asked why. Isn't this going to work? And she told me I didn't have enough experience, which I just thought was really funny because I was going
for an internship. Yeah.
Right. And the funny part about it, and the reason why I said, you know, I have the email, I actually printed it out recently and I'm getting it framed for the office. It was Def Jam, which is ultimately where Logic signed to probably a year, a little bit over a year after that. So,
all right. So you're living on Long Island with your parents and getting all these rejections for internships. So what? Like, you decide, maybe I'll just do this on my own without an internship? Like, maybe I'll just figure this out?
Yeah, and to be honest, I didn't have another choice. Huh. I couldn't get an internship. I didn't have any relationships or, you know, friends or family that worked in the business that could give me an opportunity. So, yeah, I didn't have a choice. That was the only path that I had.
So what did you decide to, like, start a business, or did you just first decide, let me kind of scour the internet and see if I can find someone?
Yeah, I think that starting a business came a little bit later. I was just like, you know what, let me find some talent. Let me reach out to them and just kind of start a dialogue and try to build a relationship with some of them and, you know, convince them to let me manage them.
How did you come across Logic stuff?
Yeah, it was kind of by chance. It was, you know, I use the word serendipity. I was managing an artist, a rapper, out of Philly at the time, and this was 2011, so it was very early days of Twitter, you know, and I probably at the time followed 25, 30 people. And I was sitting in front of my computer, and his DJ, the rapper's DJ that I managed from Philly, tweeted out a YouTube link, right? There was no description. There was no anything else in the tweet. It was just the link, and I clicked it. It was a acapella video of Logic rapping at the University of Maryland campus, and it was super low budget and poorly done. There was wind in the microphone. He actually, I think, had the microphone like tucked in his hoodie. There was just something about it that stood out to me, and I thought it was really special, and I kind of dug in a little deeper to try and find out who he was and reached out to him.
What did you say? Like, I'm Chris and I'm a manager?
Yeah, I'm a manager. You know, can we jump on the phone? Do you have... First of all, I probably asked him if he had management because I didn't want to step on anybody's toes.
Sure.
You have to understand it's, you know, I'm a kid trying to get another kid to trust me with their career. Yeah. I had no...
Yes!
I had no experience, no resume. I think I pointed to some of or one of the other artists I was working with at the time and say, hey, you know, I'm working with this artist. We had built this so far, you know, check it out. And I'd love to be involved.
All right. Just time out for a sec, Chris. This is what I'm trying to figure out. Like, you were 20 years old and you were emailing like different potential artists, including Logic at the time, who was, you know, not that well known. And you were saying, I'm a manager. What did you know? Like, what did that mean to you? Like, how would you even know what to do? Like, were there books that said, hey, here's how to be the manager of a recording artist? Like, how did you know how to negotiate contracts and find venues and record music? Like, how did you know how to do any of that?
I didn't, to be honest. You know, a lot of what I was doing was learning as I went. And looking back now, I'm very grateful and glad that I did learn that way, because I think that's the best way to learn. A lot of management and a lot of the music business is very difficult. I don't think you can learn it in a textbook.
Yeah. And I should mention, you called your company, Visionary Music Group, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a great name. It makes it sound like a huge company, like you've got a big building in Hollywood. Visionary Music Group.
Yeah, it was, I remember I made, and at the time, having to come up with a company name, it was more just to kind of, you know, I formed an LLC when I started to make money because I had to be paid, and I had a little, I remember, a Microsoft Word document with some names, and I ended up landing on the word visionary. I thought it was, at the time, fitting. I think that's how Logic and I, you know, looked at ourselves. I think we were doing something very different. That I thought and we thought was visionary.
All right, Chris, we've been leaving Logic and Lurcher because you are sitting right next to each other. Logic, what do you remember about Chris? Like, you were, I guess, 21. This guy named Chris comes down to meet you. What was your first impression of him?
Actually, we met in New York City. It was my first time ever in New York, and it just kind of happened by chance that I was going to go there to shoot a music video. I wanted to do something that was different.
And this was like a low budget, right? A video you were doing, like, yeah.
There's low budget, and then there's no budget, and that's what we had.
Okay, you know what I mean? Sure, like, right.
We had no, right. Literally, you know, just a camera and, you know, point and shoot, as we call it. And so, yeah, I go to New York, and Chris had, like, a friend who had a rooftop, and we're like, rooftop? You know, that's content right there. So we're like, yeah, let's get a rooftop in New York. And we go there, and the music video is called Mind of Logic, and it's like skeleton me rapping at, like, 120 pounds a long time ago, just, like, winging it. Step into the mind of a young man, and if you don't, then I don't really give a damn. All I want to do is make you understand, but if you don't want to listen, I guess you ain't a part of the plan. After the shoot, he was like, hey, I want to buy you lunch, and I'm like, free food? You ain't gonna say less. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm like, okay, let's do it. And so we're kind of near Times Square. I'm like, yeah, I've never been to Times Square before, man. Like, this is great. Let's go somewhere. And he's like, okay. And I'm like, yeah, there was like a Ruby Tuesday or something like that. And I'm like, let's go, man. I'm about to get a free chicken sandwich or something. And he's like, nah, you know, yeah, I mean, it's just tourist stuff. You want to go somewhere else? And like, what I didn't realize is, you know, looking back, it's like I'm talking to a broke college student with maybe $150 in his account, like if that, like it's got to last him the next 6 years of his life. And yeah, I mean, we talked and he was like, I want to manage you. And he was honest with me. He was like, hey, look, like I'm just getting into this too. He's like, but I've made some connections. I know some people. And you know, he had met some people at blogs, different blogs online and kind of music spaces where young people were excited and word of mouth via the internet was a big deal. And I was like, all right, well, I didn't want to sign anything. That was a big thing. I was like, I don't want to sign anything. If we're going to do this, like, I don't want to sign anything. And he wasn't pushing to sign anything either. And that's a really amazing thing because he was like, yo, I'm going to walk the walk. Like, I'm going to show you that I'm going to do this. And that's what we did for about the first 6 months. And
just
then we
unsigned. You were like, okay, yeah, we can try this out, but I'm not committing to you.
Yeah, and I remember we released the music video and like overnight it had 20,000 views. Now you got to understand, dude, 20,000 views in 2011. I was going from 100 views and it was all people I knew like to that, to the point where we actually sat Chris down, all of us, and kind of, it felt like an intervention. And I was like, yo, what's up, man? You paying for views or what? Because there's like back then where like people, it was a big deal because it's kind of like fake it till you make it. People would pay and it would be fake. He's like, nah, bro. He's like, I could prove it to you. I could show you. And man, it was legit.
But even before you got to that point, like I'm trying to figure out, like, you're like eating at Ruby Tuesday or whatever. And Chris is like, hey, give me a chance. And you don't have anyone managing you at that point. And I guess you're still not kind of an unknown artist, but what made you think, yeah, I'm gonna trust this guy with zero experience who's like my age? Like, what? Because obviously we know how this story is gonna end, but at that point in 2011 you did not, and neither of you knew how this is gonna end. You both could have just like could have fizzled out. But what was it about him that you thought, yeah, I'm gonna try this?
I met a lot of shady people who wanted to manage me, you know. Older dudes who were once kind of in the industry, you know, different people who were musicians themselves or this or that. I didn't feel like I was a priority. It was a bunch of guys who knew everything and were telling me, you gotta have a girl record, you gotta have a hard record, you gotta have a record for the club, you got this, you got that, and they're like telling me what to do. And I sat down with a young man who had just as much experience as I did, and I was looking in a mirror. I was looking at a green kid who had no idea what he was doing and was prepared to risk everything to attain his dream. And he needed me as much as I needed him. And I was like, yeah, let's like YOLO, like let's do it, yeah. Man. Like, yeah. And that's what it was.
So Chris, at this point, and Logic and Chris, forgive me for kind of characterizing this way, but in a sense, like Logic, you were the brand, that the business was being built around you and your brand and your talent, and you, it's like you're the product that is, you're putting out into the world. But Chris, like when I do interviews with other entrepreneurs, it's at this point when they go out to VCs and raise money to like get the product out into the world. How are you funding this? How are you having Logic record music? And because I think at this time you were just releasing all of his music for free, just putting it out on the internet and letting anybody to take it, right?
Yeah, and what we were doing, like you said, we were building the brand. I viewed that, putting out free music, as investing in the brand, right? As we were building an audience and a fan base that was becoming more and more invested. And what that means is they would later down the road, whenever we asked for it, spend the money, meaning, oh, we're going to put out our first project for sale, or hey, we're going to put up a tour for the first time. Will you spend $12 to come see me in San Diego? Hey, we're selling t-shirts for $20. So that's how I viewed it. We were essentially monetizing free music.
So how did you guys make a living? I mean, if in 2011, 2012, you were putting out, and maybe even 2013, like you were just putting out free music, how are you guys paying your rent? How are you buying food?
My parents were very, very, very good about allowing me to live there. Again, I was still in school, so I didn't have to worry about that. Logic was still at Lenny's apartment, so we didn't have too many expenses at the time. And
mind you, not to interrupt, but like I was in College Park sleeping on Lenny's couch.
Yeah.
And we were still shopping ourselves. Like we wanted a deal. That was like the goal. And there was even independent companies that put a contract for $1.5 million in our hands.
In front of you. Wow.
In front of us. And Chris had it. And I remember he said something really corny. It was really funny. Like he was just excited. He was like, how much do you think our brand that we're creating is worth? And I was like, I don't know. And he was like, well, somebody thinks it's worth $1.5 million. And mind you, it's like, bro, like $1.5 million is a lot of money right now. Like it's like, let alone as like some super broke young kids. And so we turned it down. And long
you
story
turned
short,
it down.
We turned it down like it was nothing.
Why?
Because they wanted, first of all, we were getting screwed over on points, on royalties, on longevity. They also wanted us, they were going to take a lot of control. And we were like, no, we always have to be in control because we know what we want.
I just want to kind of pause for a second, just ask you about music for a moment, because like, what do you think it is and it was about your music that connected with people? Like it's rap, it's hip hop, but generally like, you're described as having positive messages and talking about things in an open way about your own emotions and about injustice and about anxiety and depression, all these things. Do you think that's what was connecting with people even from the beginning?
Yeah, I think I was the every man or every kid or every person or every whatever. It was like people were watching me grow up like a child star. You know what I mean? Like they listen to this and they hear me say, I can't wait to make it. I can't wait to have fans. I can't wait to be the man with the master plan. I can't wait. Like da da da. And they're like, me too. Like, I can't wait to graduate college. I can't wait to, raise my children. I can't wait to follow my dreams. I'm going to do that. And I'm like, follow your dreams. Like no matter what. And hate is going to hate. Like till I overdose. I said it once, had to say a dose. I remember living at Mary Jo's. Now I'm living like pharaohs. I work like a slave, live like a king. even today, like on a mainstream level, like so much of the things I talk about openly, from anxiety, depression, just all the, like you said, injustice, the things going on. One, I'm scared to talk about, or I was scared at a point because I was scared that of how people would perceive me or this or that. But two, it's like now it's become a trend. You know, you've got rappers, hardcore rappers, and people talking about depression and mental health. And I ain't the first one. I think it's just time, place, you know, a bit of image. Just it was this nerdy young kid that other people felt they could relate to.
Yeah. So how soon after, Chris, you started working with Logic, did you say, all right, we got to go on tour? And did you go on tour?
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how soon, but it was an intuition thing, right? Because there was no metrics at the time or data that we had that said, hey, you can sell out 30 shows across the country. It was something that we both felt, hey, I think it feels right, and I think we could probably go on a tour now. And how we did that, because that's an expensive thing, right? There's a lot of startup capital that you need to fund a tour. We ultimately signed a record deal to fund our tour because we needed the money. I think we could have waited longer if we had some money, but you know, we didn't have an opportunity to wait.
And just to clarify, this is 2012. The record deal you signed is with Def Jam?
Yeah, this is 2012. Yeah, No ID comes to you, you know, legendary producer who's, you know, new executive at Def Jam. And Def Jam in general, like Def Jam Records, the most iconic hip-hop rap label, is willing to sign you, give you great money, give you creative control. It was kind of like, if there's a time, like, now's the time. And yeah, but I'll tell you this, it was very difficult, you know, looking at a check and seeing, you know, lower six figures, very lower, just six figures in an advance, which is still great. And then literally going, okay, well, you know, after X, Y, and Z takes their percentage, just on my team management and lawyer at that time, I have to put all of this into a tour. That was a hard thing, but it just as a young man who's like, oh, wait, I just got this check and now I got to let it all go, but it was worth it.
Right. This is your sweat equity in the brand, basically.
Yeah.
This is like you had to kind of put all that. So you could have gone through that tour and been broke and we might not be talking today. I mean, that was a very real possibility.
The odds were in that favor, that it wasn't going to happen.
When we come back in just a moment, Logic and Chris hit the road. But there will be speed bumps ahead, with money and mental health all on the line. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Simply Almond. Simply Almond is the alt dairy milk you would expect from Simply, made with simple ingredients for an all-natural, delicious taste. This almond milk comes in four varieties: original, unsweetened original, vanilla, and unsweetened vanilla. It's a perfect addition to cereal, smoothies, and recipes. Or just pour some in a glass and enjoy. Discover more about Simply Almond at drinksimplybeverages.com. The following message comes from NPR sponsor NI with their new podcast, Testing 123. How do engineers teach AI to make human, even ethical, decisions in self-driving cars? Or would you get on an elevator that wasn't tested? Testing 123 explores these thoughts, celebrating the unexpected challenges that engineers and innovators face and the value of testing. Testing 123 is now available at ni.com/perspectives or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Bubble.io, a no-code platform that enables you to build, launch, and scale real ideas and products without investing thousands of dollars on engineers or wasting time trying to code it yourself. Join over 1 million builders and use Bubble's drag-and-drop tool to develop and launch custom, interactive, multi-user web apps in hours. Go to bubble.io/NPR, and the first 500 listeners will get their first month free on any of Bubble's paid plans.
There are arrowheads in the walls.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei.
I'm Rund Abdel-Fattah, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
and for our special series this month, The Best of Throughline.
You know, if we carry on as we have been, this is what we might wind up with.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2012. Logic and his manager, Chris Saru, have signed a record deal with Def Jam, but it's hardly glamorous. They still haven't cut an album, and the money they got from that first deal, they had to put most of it towards their first tour.
We toured the country in a minivan and a Nissan Altima, right? I rented from Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And I remember filling out the paperwork, and it specifically said that the vehicles could not leave New York State. And we were literally touring the country, and the way it was routed, we were going to California and back. So I was like, all right, they'll never know we left. And then I ended up getting, you know, 1,000,001 tickets for going through tolls and all over the country. But no, it was not first class and five-star accommodations. We were lugging garbage bags, and we were, you know, selling merch after shows. I'd run and sell merch after shows. Logic would come over to the merch booth and meet fans, and so it was like a mom and pop tour, and we tried to figure it out, and I had my right hand man today, the COO of Visionary Music Group, Harrison Remler, at the time. He was in school. He was 18 years old.
Wow. And this was your only employee at the time?
At the time, he wasn't even an employee. I think he was interning for me. And I said to him, I said, hey, because I realized very quickly that I couldn't be on the road full time and try and sustain and run the business. It was very difficult. I think I did the first 2 weeks of it. And I remember saying to him, hey, dude, you know, would you like to tour manage? And he was, sure. And I threw him on the road. And again,
we didn't know what we were doing. It was terrible.
We had no idea what we were doing. My accounting system was manila envelopes. So before tour, I kind of wrote out every show. So you had Denver, Colorado, and we'd settle the shows in cash. At the time, that tour was actually a no guarantee tour. So the risk was massive.
Tell him very quick, because it's something I want to say. Tell him about what happened with the money.
Oh.
Trust me.
Again, it was manila envelopes, and I'd settle, and we'd, you know, put the cash in an envelope and seal it. We ended up finishing the tour. So I had these, I think it was 30 shows. I had 30 different envelopes. And looking back, we just did so, I kept a backpack on the tour of all of the envelopes with all of the cash, and would carry it around. And we would just leave it in a green room and walk away. Now, if someone had took that backpack, that was the entire income from the whole
wow.
tour. So we ended up getting back, and I'd later put everything into, you know, an Excel spreadsheet and try and, you know, log everything. So I would take out the cash and I would, you know, count it and put it on top of the manila envelope. And I was at my house at the time. Harrison was helping me. I was working still. And Harrison was like, yo, I got it. Don't worry about it. I'll finish up here. I said, cool. I ran off to work and I came back.
What was your job, by the way?
I worked at it was called Rule. It was like an Abercrombie & Fitch, you know, retail store.
And this is after going on tour with Logic, managing Logic's tour. You were back at the mall working retail.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. Okay. All right.
And,
okay.
And I came back, and the envelopes were gone. There was just 30 piles of cash that I had no idea what belonged to what. And I called Harrison, and I think he ended up trying to clean up. So he took the envelopes and ripped them up and threw them out. So
you were hot. Yo, Chris was so mad. We had all this cash. We didn't know where it was. We didn't know how to divvy it. But I say all this to say that Harrison went from fumbling 20 grand or whatever we had to juggling millions and millions of dollars in this company with Chris. And it just goes to show that some 19-year-old kid is now this young 30 under 30 boss. And I just had to show some love to Terry.
So you basically are, your accounting system is jotting it on the back of a manila envelope and then later on inserting this into Excel. But you walk away from that tour in the black. You made some cash.
Yeah, we did really well.
Yeah,
we did really well.
It was awesome.
How do do you, and this is a super awkward question for both of you, but I always ask this of partnerships because it is part of business. Like, how do you figure out who gets paid what? I mean, obviously, Logic, you're out there. You're the face of this organization. Like, you represent all of the people now who work for Visionary Music Group and the other people involved. And so, Chris, like, how did you know how to divide that up?
There's right, a typical commission is how management works.
Right, it's like 15% or 10%.
Yeah, anywhere from 15 to 20% is the traditional commission for a manager. I've learned to love the commission model the more that I've grown. It's because you don't eat unless everybody eats. There's not one person, you know, at the table that has a full plate when you're starving. It's that's why I've learned to love commission.
Yeah.
And things are crazy now. You know what I mean? $30+ million deals here and there, doing this, doing that. But you gotta look in the mirror and say, like, well, does this person deserve it? Truly, like, yes or no. Take your ego out of it. Take one in an extra mil here or there in a deal that if they had a lower percentage or but the truth is, man, like, he earns every penny because he provides that with me. I don't feel cheated. I never felt that things were unfair or this or that. And we're so open. We have conversations about it. We have talks about it.
Right.
And also, to be fair, when you get to my level, there's a bunch of different people in your pocket, but they're all there to make you money. But I am always the majority. And I think that that is fair. And where you find yourself with artists who are being like taken for 70%, like, it's just, I mean, that is insane as a collective. And that's where the music industry is really horrible, vile, and they chew you up and spit you out. But this is my friend and my brother in arms.
And I think that's the secret element that has enabled us to be successful for so long is it's really simple. It's just genuinely caring about that person's well-being. And what I mean by that, you know, going back to 2012, when we had a $1.5 million offer, I knew in my gut it wasn't the right opportunity. They were not the right partner. It was not a good deal. But if I had just suggested or advised him that we take this deal, because I didn't really care what happened to him. I wanted to get my commission and get my check and then, you know, I'm out. But I didn't.
So this is 2012. It's still going to be like another 2 years before you guys release your first studio record. But between that point and the release of the studio record, you still are releasing mixtapes. Were you guys selling that, or were you just, again, still kind of building the brand and releasing the music for free?
We were still putting out for free. That tour was a massive eye-opener for us. It was what Logic and I had thought we were building. It proved to us, and I think everybody else, that it was something very real. Bringing out 300-400 kids in different cities across the country, from putting out free albums and free mixtapes, and selling a lot of merch, and it became very real at that time. And we wanted to keep that going because, again, we were building leverage and building his brand. So our thing was, we wanted to make a splash when it was his time for a debut album. We wanted to have a really big first week sales. So we decided to continue building and putting out free products.
What I'm trying to figure out is, how did you get the word out? Like, we've done interviews with, like, the founder of Glossier, the cosmetics brand, and she started with a beauty blog. And over time, she just, you know, she built a following, and then she introduced the brand of the products, the product line. And then we've done episodes with, like, the founders of Instagram and how that was kind of a slow build. Like, how did people discover Logic's music? I mean, you can't just put it out on the internet and hope people will find it, right?
No, it was much more thoughtful, and there was a strategy behind everything. I think what I did a lot is I watched, right? I would watch the way other artists would break, and I would try and reverse engineer that. And figure out, okay, this is really interesting. YouTube is an amazing tool at the time for being discovered, because the way their algorithm worked and their suggested video algorithm, if you remember, and it's still there today, I think it's much different now on the right-hand side. If you'd be watching a certain video, a music video would suggest another artist, that's something that we took advantage of. I sat down with Logic, we would go through the project, and I'd say, okay, let's identify four or five songs that we think are singles, and we'd shoot no budget, low budget, point and shoot music videos for those, because that was a way for us to get more attention to those songs. And as social media started to come out, paying attention to that, I remember the very early days of Snapchat was something that we took advantage of, and Logic was on there and building, you know, a big audience on that platform. And then Instagram played a role, and we tried to be first movers and on these platforms quick. Logic did a great job at, you know, speaking directly to his audience.
It's always about, sorry to cut you off, in like taking something that's already been done and making it better. You know, I've recently come out with this thing called Freestyle Fridays on my Instagram, where you essentially create a perfect loop of a song, and it seems like it's a never-ending music video that doesn't stop. Right. And I don't necessarily know of anybody who's done that, at least not on a mainstream platform, but it's like finding ways with something that already exists to put your own stamp on it and make people want it.
And all that Freestyle Friday thing it's just crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
Logic and I were just having a conversation. We came up with the idea. Now we get to go and look at 15,000 comments and see what their opinion is on the song before we put it out. And we can decide, hey, is that something we want to put out? Should that make the album or not?
I mean, it sounds like you had this slow build from sort of 2000, well, for you, Logic, from 2009, but once you entered the picture, Chris, really the first 2 years were sounds like they were focused on building up, you know, the brand awareness, like who is making sure people knew who Logic was. So by the time you put out your first studio record in 2014, Under Pressure, that record, what, I think it debuted or went right to number 4 on the Billboard charts, which is like, I mean, were you guys surprised by that? Were you shocked, or did you think, yep, this is exactly as we planned it?
We were devastated, actually. yeah, no, I mean, I think we were legitimately devastated. For us, it was a number one album or bust. And
wait, that was a number 4 record on the Billboard charts. You were devastated that it wasn't number 1?
Devastated. Because, wow. And that was where, again, looking back, I think I could have done a better job probably at educating the record company and making them feel a little bit more involved in the early days as we were building still very much independently. Like, we were putting out these free albums and touring the country. At that point, I think he had gone on.
I think you did a great job. I'm sorry to interrupt you, bro. You did an amazing job. And we were working with people who aren't at that company anymore, because it's like musical chairs, who didn't believe in your vision. And you know, you're talking about like communicating, bro. You did a fantastic job. And to say what Chris won't, they undershipped us. They didn't believe in us so much that they undershipped my album.
Yeah.
And you had all these other huge artists with, you know, 400,000 plus CDs in stores. And I had fans going to Best Buys, having to have the workers there go to the back and take it out of the box because our label didn't believe in us enough to even buy shelf space. Not just new release shelf space, but shelf space. So I just have to say, you're the man, bro, and you did your job.
But I have to say, let's put some perspective on this for a sec. I mean, there are thousands of records that are released every single week around the world. Like, number 4 on the U.S. Billboard charts, a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percentage of albums will ever get that high. That's a huge achievement. I mean, that, like, even if, okay, I believe you that you were sad it wasn't number 1, but it sounds like you spent the first 2 years building up the awareness, and by the time that album came out, it was gonna sell a lot of records. It sold 500,000 copies, I guess, eventually.
Yeah, I think that was the first time that we proved to not only ourselves, because I didn't think we needed to. I think we understood it, and we believed in and knew what we were building. But I think we proved to the business and really the world that what we had built, I think a lot of people viewed it as almost like building it in a vacuum. I remember having the conversations and being incredibly frustrated, you know, with the head of sales at the time at Def Jam, where he didn't understand, because he's like, hey, you have never sold a song in the history of your career. And I'm like, that's accurate. But we had sold 100,000 tickets, an X number of dollars in merch. So that's going to translate, because it's fans who are invested in him, right? And it's the first time we're asking them, not even asking, we're putting out music for sale. If they're coming to shows and selling out rooms across the country and we're selling out shows all over Europe, they're going to buy an album for $7.99. To me, it was, that was the next logical step, is like, okay, it's just the natural progression of his career. Now he's a major label artist and we're going to sell music.
Logic, when you perform, right, do you feel like you're the same person? Do you feel like you're sort of a heightened version of yourself? Do you feel like you're almost embodying a character when you're on stage?
Oh man, I think I'm me at my purest form in a way. Like
the best version of you?
Yeah, well, not even. I think the most vulnerable. I used to be so nervous if I would mess up a line or flub here or do this or do that. But then you got to realize, it's like, do you know how many lyrics are in my mind? Like right now, one breath. Get down or lay down, hit you with the brevetti, you better stay down. Straight shots in a playground, living how I'm living with the life that I'm giving. Anybody just ride them with me, I'm riding with them. Show me the enemy and I'ma hit him the second I bit him. I get him and hit him with the venom. Ain't no need to pretend I'ma never do it. I knew it, already been through it. I do it for the street, for the fam, for the life, anybody that's gang related. Like, wow. Do you know how many times I had to mess that up to be able to do it like that?
I cannot imagine.
Yeah, but it's like I was kicking myself. It wasn't good enough. I was Michael Jackson, and after the show, I was Joe Jackson looking in the mirror like, how could you do this? And then I kind of started to realize, like, yo, it ain't that deep, man. Like, and it was because I felt I was at a time where I needed to, like, prove myself, so everything had to be perfect. But it's like, yo, if you hit one wrong key, bro, it ain't that deep. You know why? Because you have a sold-out arena at the Garden of people who, if you make a mistake, if anything, it makes them feel a further connection to you, because
totally.
They make mistakes, because we all make mistakes. So it's definitely a heightened version, but a more vulnerable version.
You guys released the second studio release was The Incredible True Story. That debuted at number 3 on the Billboard charts. Your third album, Everybody, debuts at number 1, and I think a huge turning point in terms of like your mainstream popularity, and maybe I think it's fair to say superstardom, was a song 1-800-273-8255 that came out in 2017. How did that song come about?
Oh man, it's so crazy. So earlier with the second album, we did a tour where, you know, we paid 6 figures for a tour bus for fans to go to their homes and surprise them and play them the second album before it was even out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we ate dinner with these people and met their families and their friends. And I heard about their hopes and dreams and hard times and happy times. And the biggest thing that I heard, you know, when they would talk about my music, they're like, yeah, dude, I love your music. Like, it goes without saying, like, you make great music. And I'm like, wow, well, thank you. But they're like, but that's not it. The reason I love you, like Logic and your brand and what you represent, is because of the message. You know, and there's people who are like, you know, you've saved my life. Your music has saved my life. And I, after that, I thought about it for a long time and I was like, yo, I didn't even try to do that. And I actually have the power to do that. Could you imagine what that would be like? And so when I wrote it, I knew it had to be simple, man. It had to be, and it just came. It just was, we were just in the studio and I had the hook and I sang it and then I did the verse. And then I knew in my heart, I was like, man, I need other people on this. And I need other young, influential people, you know, that can help get this message out. Mind you, I'm not in the studio like, yo, this song about killing yourself is about to be a banging number one. Like, no, like, no way. Nobody, I don't care. Nobody saw that. Like, nobody saw that. And it was Chris who had the idea to make it 1-800-275, you know, and really give it the whole number, because then we could reach people and give them that platform. All this other shit I'm talking about, they think they know it. I've been praying for somebody to save me, no one's heroic in my life. Don't even matter, I know it, I know it. I know I'm hurting deep down, but can't show it. I never had a place to call my own. And that number, the name of the song, 1-800-273-8255, that is the telephone number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is, I mean, wow, like you could have called that song I Want to Be Alive or something else. And you, by giving it that title of the phone number, it was like, it was just super powerful. And did you know that? you know, hindsight's like 20/20. Like,
sure,
we could sit here now and be like, oh, of course it could have been. But like, no, like, especially with what was on the radio. I mean, it's glorification and we knew it was a great song. And it's funny because then the song comes out and you got people like, well, of course it's going to do well because, and it's like, get out of here, man. We had no clue.
Did you, I mean, I understand that you are singing on that record from different perspectives of sort of embodying different voices, but did you ever feel that way? Were you ever suicidal in your life?
Here's the crazy thing. I've never thought, I've thought about killing myself. I've thought about punching a cash register. These are intrusive thoughts that just happen. We're human. Like they happen. And
sure.
It wasn't until I was like, I experienced true depression and didn't even know I was depressed while I was touring and working that song. Because everywhere I was going, it's suicide, suicide, suicide. Talk about killing yourself. Talk about this. Let's talk about this. Oh, death, death, death. And I mean, can you imagine doing a solid year of talking about killing yourself? Even if you aren't like talking about killing yourself in particular as the artist singing the song, but it's like, yo, and that is crazy. And going from like, I'd given up on trying to get a hit record. And I remember telling Chris before that album, I was like, I'm done. I don't want to do it. I was always like in the studio trying to make hits. That doesn't mean I wasn't trying to make something from the heart. But it's like, man, I wanted to be Drake and Rick Ross and this. I wanted to be that popular guy too. And when I gave up, I ended up making the song that did it. And then I kind of was like, oh, man, like I love this. I love being in the spotlight and being in the spotlight for a positive message. But I just worked it and worked it and grinded and did it so much where I was waking up every day and I wasn't happy going on stage.
And I guess at the end of that, sort of towards the end of that just long stretch of touring, this is in sort of the fall of 2017, you actually had a breakdown, like on a concert. What happened? This is in Pittsburgh. What happened?
Yeah, it's crazy, man. So I'm backstage throwing up before I'm going on. I'm malnourished. I'm completely unhealthy.
Were you nervous or was it just...
No, I wasn't nervous. No, I was like, you feel like you're out of your body. Like you feel like a little person in your brain, kind of like you take a swig of water and you're like, wait, did I actually drink that water right now? And what I've come to realize, I think it's a hyper analyzation of the world around you in real time, and that was really hard. So I'm going through all this, and you know, won't really get too much into it, but obviously I was dealing with like relationship issues and I'm trying to manage a company and my business and make albums and go on tours. And there was a time where I was even like I love Chris. He's my partner. And I want to like quit, not quit rap or that, but I just want to run away, but I can't because we got multi-million dollar deals on the table. And if I don't do this, then it's all going to crumble. And he's sacrificed his life for me. I'm up here. It's the weight is on my shoulders. I can't do this. I can't do that to him. I can't. And then I start realizing I'm doing shows for other people, not just him, for myself and for my future family. And I have to stack this money for my children. And I've come from nothing. And if I don't do this, it could go away. And they like me now, but then they might not later. And I go on Instagram and it's you suck and you're terrible and you're going bald and you're white and you can't rap and you're horrible and you're a disgrace to hip hop. And what is this 1-800? I liked you better when you rap like this. And somebody's like, well, I like this and you don't like, and your mind is going crazy and you step on stage and you don't want to be there after 9 months. I mean, think about 9 months on the road, 9 months of hotels, 9 months of dark places and behind the scenes and this. And I'm a human being. And that's something that a lot of people don't understand. Fame is crazy. And that's what that was. And I didn't go home and shoot guns and rob this and do, and just like, no, I went home. And I said, I'm going to go see my therapist, who I see regularly. I'm going to drink a lot of water. I'm going to work out. I'm going to eat better. And I realized that my goals have changed. You know, it's like, it's not about money anymore. It's about happiness. Why go do a show just because it's going to make me $500,000 in an hour on stage? Like, that's great. But if I'm not there, I should want to be on that stage. And now I do. I want to be on that stage because I've taken that time.
Chris, how did you... deal with Logic's anxiety and exhaustion and you know that what happened in Pittsburgh, like that wasn't just obviously that was an expression of things that were probably building up over a long time. How did you cope with it and what did you do?
I mean, I immediately you kind of put on the friend hat, right? Because that's what makes this relationship and special, is that, again, you genuinely care about him. So for me, it was a lot of questions about, hey, how can I make you feel better, and what can I change? What can we do differently to make sure something like this doesn't happen again? And we learned a lot from it, I think, both him and I, on how to move forward and conduct the business and operate on a daily basis even. It kind of changed a lot of the things we did, from just daily communication to what we say yes to what we say no to. And I think we're better for it. I think he'll say the same thing. And I think we're going to be much more successful moving forward. And it's because we got through that, and it allowed us to grow.
So when I think about like the business that you guys have created, I'm curious about where it goes from here. Like, I think about, like, if I'm an investor, right, and I go to Jay-Z or to Kanye West, like, I could buy their company outright, and Jay-Z could leave the picture, because there's still, like, an investment arm, and there's a label, and there's other things that, at this point, you don't necessarily need Jay-Z. The business can thrive. Right now, you have a business around your brand, whether it's performing or selling merchandise or the tour or writing books or acting, and all those are great, but they all require you to constantly stay on the hamster wheel. Do you ever sort of think about, how do we build something for the future that may not require both of us, that can just be a business that is even bigger than the two of us?
Well, one, I think Chris has already done that in Visionary Music Group and the partnerships that he has, but I won't speak for you. I'll let you say that. But even so, I have a record label, and we're both equal partners on that we run together, called Elysium, with artists that I've signed that we believe in, that will go out and essentially make us money, you know, by killing it. So it's those businesses, and I think that mind state, like, I have a production company, and I haven't really discussed it too much, but it's called Bobby Boy, and these are the things I'm doing my films through, and exactly. And so imagine, like, if I have this production company and I write a script and somebody else takes the wheel. So I am looking at the future through still being creative, but more so behind the scenes, because I have a fan base that wants any product I am willing to give them, as long as they are familiar with where it is coming from. So how about you, Chris? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the brand logic, there's a lot of equity in that now. And, sure, you know, I'm growing my business and have used my experience, and I think some of the relationships, and most importantly, I think the knowledge and experience that I've been able to gain while building Logic's career right next to him. I've recently took on a handful more clients. I think I have 7 management clients right now. I just did a joint venture label with Sony Music, which I'm very, very excited about. So yeah, there's a lot of things to look forward to.
But one thing I will say, though, is we kind of didn't answer his question. And the question was, what do we have? So kind of, because we have these artists, you have these artists, we have these artists that are doing things for us. I can't speak for Chris. I like to think I can when I say this. You said, you know, that we're always on the hamster wheel is always going. The truth is, my brain is a hamster wheel. It does not stop, and that's how I live. So I have to be involved some way. If I'm not involved, yeah, I trust no one with my money, with my company, with my this, with my that, if I'm not involved. Like, I trust Chris with my life, but I'm not just going to be like, just go take it. Not because I don't trust him, but because I don't work that way. I need to know how you cook the fries at McDonald's, who sweeps the floors, who flips the burgers, the exact time to flip the burgers, this, that, even if I'm sitting all the way on the 57th floor in the CEO chair, I need to know.
So this is a question that I ask everybody who comes on the show, and of course I'm going to ask both of you, and first you, Chris. When you think about the journey that you've taken, you know, 20-year-old, no experience, like pitching this guy Logic, to where you are now, like, how much of that do you attribute to just really hard work and intelligence and skill, and how much of that do you attribute to luck?
I think it's probably somewhere in the middle between the both. You know, I look back, you know, at my life, and I think being, you know, raised by my parents played a large role in who I am as a person today and instilling confidence in me. How serendipity played such a role in me discovering who Logic was. I told the story, if I hadn't been sitting at my computer at that very moment to click that YouTube link and see the video of Logic, I don't think we'd be sitting here today. But there's a large portion of that where, you know, it just takes an almost unimaginable amount of hard work and perseverance because of every roadblock and every door that's closed to figure out a way to get through it. I think it lives somewhere in the middle. I think my journey, I would probably have one foot in hard work and intelligence and grind and hustle and one foot in pure and simple luck.
Logic?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's in the beginning, it's a lot of luck, right? Because if without that luck, you wouldn't even be blessed enough to be in those positions in those situations. You know what's really funny? I can't speak for other famous people, celebrities, musicians, whatever, but I can tell you, like, no one knows how hard I work, and until you, how hard we can work. And I pay out over $1 million in salary to my employees a year. This is a real company and hard work, man.
You work hard every mother effing day.
Yeah, I work hard every mother day. Yeah. We work hard every mother day.
Hey, I work hard every mother day. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I work hard every day. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's Logic, a.k.a. Bobby Tarantino, a.k.a. Young Sinatra, a.k.a. Sir Robert Bryson Hall II, and Chris Saru, founder of Visionary Music Group. Despite the success of Logic's music, the two of them are relying on an old business strategy to keep the business relevant. Diversification. Like, a few years back, Logic published a novel, a psychological thriller called Supermarket. He also just released another book, a memoir called This Bright Future. And for the past few years, he's been working on a project with filmmaker J.J. Abrams. And Chris, as he mentioned, he launched a joint venture with Sony a few years back and built a brand new label for discovering new talent. And the label is called, what else? Visionary Records. Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you are not yet a subscriber, please do subscribe or follow wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to write to us, our email address is hibt@npr.org. To find us on Twitter, it's @HowIBuiltThis or @GuyRaz. And on Instagram, it's @HowIBuiltThisNPR or @Guy.Raz. This episode was produced by James Delahousie with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by Neva Grant with research help from Mia Venkat. Our production staff includes Casey Herman, Rachel Faulkner, J.C. Howard, Julia Carney, Elaine Coates, Farah Safari, Liz Metzger, and Annalise Ober. Our intern is Harrison B.J. Choi, and Jeff Rogers is our executive producer. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. This is NPR.